Chapter 9. Core Containment. For thousands of years, oral trad was the only story operating system, and indeed is still in use today. The recordable story operating systems began with Clay Tablet V2.1 and went through several competing systems, Wax Tablet, Papyrus, Vellum Pro, before merging into the award-winning Scroll, which was upgraded 8 times before being swept aside by the all-new and clearly superior Book V1. Stable, easy to store and transport, compact, and with a workable index, Book has led the way for nearly 1,800 years. I turned to the guard on the left. "If I ask the other guard," I said with some trepidation, "which was the door to the containment chamber, which one would he say?" The guard thought for a moment and pointed to one of the doors, and I turned back to look at Sparkle and the somewhat concerned face of Thursday Five, who was rapidly coming to terms with the idea that there was a lot of weird shit in the book world that she'd no idea how to handle, such as potential tiger attacks inside Pinocchio. "Have you chosen your door, Miss Next?" asked Julian Sparkle. "Remember, if you win, you get through to core containment, and if you lose, there is a high probability of being eaten. Choose your door wisely." I gave a smile and grasped the handle, not on the door that had been indicated by the guard, but the other one. I pulled it open to reveal a flight of steps leading downward. Sparkle's eyebrow twitched, and he grimaced momentarily, before breaking once more into an insincere grin. The two guards breathed a sigh of relief and removed their helmets to mop their brows. It was clear that dealing with tigers wasn't something they much liked to do, and the tiger, itself a bit miffed, growled from behind the other door. "Congratulations," muttered Sparkle. "You have chosen correctly." I nodded to Thursday Five, who joined me at the doorway, leaving Sparkle and the two guards arguing over what my super-duper prize should be. "How did you know which guard was which?" she asked in a respectful tone. "I didn't," I replied, "and still don't. But I assumed that the guards would know who told the truth and who didn't, since my question would always show me the wrong door, irrespective of whom I asked. I just took the opposite of the one indicated." "Oh," she said, trying to figure it out. "What were they doing there, anyway?" "Sparkle and the others are what we call anecdotals. Brain teasers, puzzles, jokes, anecdotes, and urban legends that are in the oral tradition but not big enough to exist on their own. Since they need to be instantly retrieved, they have to be flexible and available at a moment's notice, so we billet them, unseen around the various works of fiction." "I get it," replied Thursday. "We had the joke about the centipede playing rugby with us at Fiasco for a while. Out of sight of the readers, of course. Total pest. We kept on tripping over his boots." We stopped at the foot of the stairs. The room was about the size of a double garage, and seemed to be constructed of riveted brass that was green with oxidation. The walls were gently curved, giving the impression that we were inside a huge barrel, and there was a hollow, cathedral-like quality to our voices. In the center of the room was a circular, waist-high bronze plinth, about the size and shape of a ship's capstan, upon which two electrodes sprouted upward, and then bent gently outward until they were about 6 inches apart. At the end of each electrode was a carbon sphere no bigger than a ping-pong ball, and between the two of them a languid blue arc of electricity crackled quietly to itself. "What's that?" asked Thursday Five in a deferential whisper. "It's the spark, the notion, the core of the book, the central nub of energy that binds a novel together." We watched for a few moments as the arc of energy moved in a lazy wave between the poles. Every now and then it would fizzle as though somehow disturbed by something. "It moves as the crickets talk to each other upstairs," I explained. "If the book were being read, you'd really see the sparks flicker and dance. I've been in the core of Anna Karenina when it was going full bore with 50,000 simultaneous readings, and the effect was better than any fireworks display. A multi-stranded spark in 1,000 different hues that snaked and arced out into the room and twisted around one another. The book's reason for being is to be read. The spark reflects this in a shimmering light show of dynamic proportions."
"You speak as though it were alive."
"Sometimes I think it is," I mused, staring at the spark. "After all, a story is born, it can evolve, replicate, and then die. I used to go down to core containment quite a lot, but I don't have as much time for it these days." I pointed at a pipe about the width of my arm that led out from the plinth and disappeared into the floor. "That's the throughput pipe that takes all the readings to the StoryCode engine floor at Text Grand Central, and from there to the Outland, where they're channeled direct to the reader's imagination."
"And all books work this way?"
"I wish. Books that are not within the influence of Text Grand Central have their own onboard story code engines, as do books being constructed in the Well of Lost Plots and most of the vanity publishing genre." Thursday Five looked thoughtful.
"The readers are everything, aren't they?"
"Now you've got it," I replied. "Everything." We stood in silence for a moment.
"I was just thinking about the awesome responsibility that comes with being a jurisfiction agent," I said at last. "What were you thinking about?"
"Me?"
I looked around the empty room.
"Yes, you." "I was wondering if extracting aloe vera hurt the plant."
"What's that?"
She was pointing at a small round hatch that was partially hidden behind some copper tubing. It looked like something you might find in the watertight bulkhead of a submarine. Riveted and of robust construction, it had a large central lever and two locking devices farther than an arm span apart, so it could never be opened accidentally by one person.
"That leads to nothing," I murmured.
"You mean a blank wall?"
"No, a blank wall would be something. This is not a nothing, but the nothing. The nothing by which all somethings are defined."
She looked confused, so I beckoned her to a small porthole next to the hatch and told her to look out.
"I can't see anything," she said after a while. "It's completely black."
"No, wait. I can see small pinpoints of light, like stars."
"Not stars," I told her. "Books. Each one adrift in the firmament, and each one burning not just with the light that the author gave it upon creation, but with the warm glow of being read and appreciated. The brighter ones are the most popular."
"I can see millions of them," she murmured, cupping her hands around her face to help her eyes penetrate the inky blackness.
"Every book is a small world unto itself, reachable only by book jumping. See how some points of light tend to group near others?"
"Yes."
"They're clumped together in genres, attracted by the gravitational tug of their mutual plot lines."
"And between them?"
"An abstraction where all the laws of literary theory and storytelling conventions break down. The nothing. It doesn't support textual life and has no description, form, or function." I tapped the innocuous-looking hatch. "Out there, you'd not last a second before the text that makes up your descriptive existence was stripped of all meaning and consequence. Before book jumping was developed, every character was marooned in his or her own novel. For many of the books outside the influence of the Council of Genres and Text Grand Central, it's still like that. Pilgrim's Progress and the Sherlock Holmes series are good examples. We know roughly where they are, due to the literary influence they exert on similar books, but we still haven't figured out a way in. And until someone does, a book jump is impossible." I switched off the light, and we returned to Geppetto's kitchen.
"Here you go," said Julian Sparkle, handing me a cardboard box.
Any sort of enmity he might have felt towards us had vanished.
What's this?
Why, your prize, of course, a selection of Tupperware containers, durable and with ingenious spill-proof lids. They're the ideal way to keep food fresh.
Give them to the tiger.
He doesn't like Tupperware. The lids are tricky to get off with his paws.
Then you have them.
I didn't win, replied Sparkle, with a trace of annoyance.
But then he added, after a moment's thought,
However, if you would like to play our Super Wizzo Double Jackpot game, we can double your prize the next time you play.
Good, fine, whatever, I said, as a phone on the kitchen table started jangling. Julian picked it up.
Hello? Two doors, one tiger, liar, non-liar puzzle speaking.
He raised his eyebrows and grabbed a handy pen to scribble a note.
We'll be onto it right away.
He replaced the phone and addressed the two guards, who were watching him expectantly.
Scramble, lads. We're needed on a boring car journey on the M4 westbound near Lynham.
The room was suddenly a whirl of activity. Each guard removed his door, which seemed to be on quick-release hinges, and then held it under his arm. The first guard placed his hand on the shoulder of Sparkle, who had turned his back, and the second on the shoulder of his compatriot. The tiger, now free, stood behind the second guard and placed one paw on his shoulder, and with the other lifted the telephone off the table.
Ready? Called out Sparkle to the odd line that had formed expertly behind him.
Yes, said the first guard.
No, said the second.
Growl, said the tiger, and turned to wink at us.
There was a mild concussion as they all jumped out. The fire blazed momentarily in the grate. The cat ran out of the room, and loose papers were thrown into the air. Phone call to exit had taken less than 8 seconds. These guys were professionals. Thursday Five and I, suitably impressed and still without a taxi, jumped out of Pinocchio and were once again in the great library. She replaced the book on the shelf and looked up at me. Even if I had played Liars and Tigers, she said with a mournful sigh, I wouldn't have been able to figure it out. I'd have been eaten. Not necessarily, I replied. Even by guessing, your chances were still 50-50. And that's thought favourable odds at jurisfiction.
You mean I have a 50% chance of being killed in the service?
Consider yourself lucky. Out in the real world, despite huge advances in medical science, the chance of death remains unchanged at 100%. Still, there's a bright side to the human mortality thing. At least, there is for the book world.
Which is?
A never-ending supply of new readers. Come on, you can jump me back to the jurisfiction offices. She stared at me for a moment, and then said,
You're not so good at book jumping anymore, are you?
Not really. But that's between you and me, yes?
Do you want to talk about it?
No.